You know that feeling when you're watching a really, really good movie
Yeah.
and you get so sucked in, you just forget someone actually wrote it?
Oh, completely. You forget there's a person, at a desk typing out every single line.
Right. We want to believe the story is just happening.
Exactly. Acknowledging the writer kind of breaks the magic.
But what if you couldn't ignore them? What if you were in a theater and you were watching the movie, but you were also watching the writer struggle to write the movie all at the same time?
And that right there is where we are today. We're doing a deep dive into a show that doesn't just put the writer on stage, it forces him to sing a duet with his own main character.
We are talking, of course, about the musical City of Angels.
Yes.
I am so excited for this one because honestly, on paper, it sounds like it should be a complete mess.
It's such a high wire act.
It's two different shows fighting for the same stage.
It is one of the most ambitious things I think Broadway has ever tried. You have, on one side, a gritty 1940s film noir detective story. And on the other side, at the same time, you have the Technicolor stress fest of a Hollywood writer trying to bring that story to life.
And it's not just a cool gimmick. Our sources frame this as a really deep commentary on the whole creative process. It's basically art versus commerce.
That's the battle. The writer, Stein, is art, and the movie producer is commerce.
An age-old struggle.
And City of Angels turns it into a musical comedy. It premiered on Broadway, December 11th, 1989, at the Virginia Theater. And the creative team was just, royalty. Music by Cy Coleman,
A legend.
lyrics by David Zippel, and book by Larry Gelbart.
Larry Gelbart from M. Ashe. So you already know the dialogue is going to be razor sharp.
Oh, unbelievably sharp. And their whole mission was to tell these two stories at once and somehow not confuse the audience completely.
So let's get into how they pulled it off. Because the staging, I mean, this was 1989. No giant LED screens, no digital projections. How did they do it?
It was all practical, old school stage magic. The central idea, we can call it double vision, the stage is split, and they use color to tell you exactly where you are.
Okay, this is the part that just blows my mind. Let's start with the movie world.
Right. So half the story is the actual movie being written. It's
Right.
about a private eye named Stone, classic 1940s Los Angeles.
Okay.
And to make it feel like a film noir, the team made this incredibly bold choice. Everything in Stone's world is in black and white.
When you say everything,
Yeah.
you don't just mean the backdrops.
I mean, literally everything. The sets were grayscale, the costumes, black, white, and gray. The props, and here's the kicker, the makeup on the actors was gray.
No way.
If one of them had walked off the stage, they would have looked like a living, breathing black and white photo.
That is an incredible commitment to a bit. And then next to that, you have the Hollywood world.
Exactly. The real world of the writer, Sign, and his world is in blazing technicolor, just super saturated, bright, almost overwhelming color.
So you, as the audience, you never have to guess. Gray means fiction, color means reality.
You get it instantly. But the real genius is that these worlds don't just sit there next to each other, they interact. Stein, the writer in color, is physically controlling the black and white world.
Okay, the sources gave a perfect example of this, the rewind scene in Act One. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite theatrical moments ever. You have Stone, the detective, and his secretary, Uli, in the middle of a scene. They're talking, bantering, and then suddenly they just freeze.
They just stop.
Completely, because over in the color world, Stein stops typing at his typewriter. He doesn't like the line he just wrote. So he hits the backspace key, and on stage, the black and white actors start moving in reverse. They walk backwards, their speech is garbled, they undo their actions until they're back at the start of the scene.
That sounds incredibly difficult for the
Well, it's
actor.
insanely technical, but it immediately shows you the power dynamic. These tough noir characters, they're just puppets for the guy at the typewriter.
For now, anyway. But there's another layer to this, right? The casting.
Yes, the casting strategy is so clever. Most of the actors play dual roles. It's a mirror effect. So the actress playing Gabby, who is Stein's wife in the real world,
Okay.
she also plays Bobby, the lost love of the detective, Stone, in the movie world.
And Donna, the real world secretary, plays Uli, the movie world secretary.
Right. And it's not just to save money, it's a psychological thing. It shows you that Stein is writing what he knows. He's taking the people from his real life and recasting them in his
So
fantasy.
he's working out his real life issues through his characters.
Exactly. He's trying to win arguments on the page that he's losing at home.
That is A little messed up, actually.
That's the writer's life, I guess. You rewrite reality until it makes sense.
Okay, so let's dig into the actual plot of the movie he's writing. The sources say it's just like a checklist of every film noir trope.
It's a loving tribute. It's not making fun of noir, it's celebrating it. So you've got Stone. He's an ex-cop, of course. Cynical, broke.
Classic.
And then the client walks in, Alora Kingsley.
What a great name.
The ultimate femme fatale. She's beautiful, she's rich, and she hires him to find her missing stepdaughter, Mallory.
Who is, of course, a bad girl.
Naturally. And from there, it all goes wrong. Stone gets beaten up, framed for murder, and he's got this bitter rival cop, Munoz, on his tail. It's basically the Maltese Falcon set to a jazz score.
So while Stone is getting physically beaten up, Stein, the writer, is getting metaphorically beaten up in Hollywood.
That's the parallel. Stein's bad guy is a producer named Buddy Fiddler, and Buddy is the absolute embodiment of the old studio system.
Let's unpack that for a second. What made the producer the villain back then?
Well, in the 40s, the studio owned everything, including the writers. A producer like Buddy could take your novel, your serious work of art, and just chop it to pieces to sell more tickets.
He's the guy who says, I love it, now change everything.
Precisely. And he's constantly chipping away at Stein's script, cutting the social commentary, demanding a happier ending.
And the sources point out this amazing irony. In the movie, Stone is the man of honor. He resists temptation. But Stein, the real guy, is weak.
That's the heart of the show. Stein is cheating on his wife, Gabby, with his secretary, Donna.
Okay.
At the same time, in the movie, his character, Stone, is faced with the same temptation. Mallory, the missing girl, shows up in his bed.
The classic noir trap.
But Stone, the character, kicks her out. He has a code. Stein, his creator, does not. So the fiction is actually a better man than the fact.
And this all explodes in the Act One finale, right? The song, You're Nothing Without Me.
Oh, it's a showstopper.
It's the creator literally arguing with his creation.
It is a metaphysical showdown with a full big band orchestra. Stein is screaming, I made you, you're nothing without me. And Stone is screaming back, you're a mess. I'm the hero you're too scared to be.
It's just such a brilliant idea for a song.
And the music is electric, which, you know, brings us to the score.
Yeah, let's talk about Cy Coleman. The sources call this a delirious celebration of jazz. It's not your typical Broadway sound.
Not at all. Coleman was a jazz pianist first. And you can hear it. The whole score is drenched in late 40s jazz. Complicated rhythms, tight vocal harmonies, scatting. It's really sophisticated.
The one song that kept coming up was the tennis song.
Oh, it's a masterclass in lyrics. On the surface, it's a duet between Stone and Alora about a tennis match. They're talking about their serve, their backhand.
But they are not talking about tennis.
Not even a little bit. It is one long, brilliant, sexual double entendre. It perfectly captures that witty, coded dialogue you'd get in old movies from the Hays Code era.
And then you have the really moody stuff, like With Every Breath I Take.
Beautiful torch song. It just sounds like it belongs in a smoky nightclub in 1948.
But on the other hand, you have the satire. I love the part where the producer, yep, Buddy, wants to cast a shallow crooner named Jimmy Powers to play the tough detective.
Right, and Jimmy Powers is completely wrong for the part. He's this lightweight pop star. But he's famous.
And bankability is more important than suitability.
Exactly. And Stein is just losing his mind watching his gritty creation get turned into a vehicle for a pop idol. It's a timeless critique of stunt casting.
So the show opens in 89. It wins all the Tonys. Sounds like a huge hit. But there's this financial detail in the sources that is, frankly, terrifying.
Yeah, the Frank Rich effect.
Frank Rich was the critic for the New York Times, the butcher of Broadway.
He could make or break a show with a single review. And City of Angels, before it officially opened, was in serious trouble.
How much trouble?
The sources say that during previews, the box office was making about $18,000 a day.
Which sounds like a lot, but for a Broadway show.
It's a death sentence. They were on the verge of closing.
So they were basically dead on arrival.
And then Frank Rich's review came out, and he didn't just like it. He raved. He wrote, how long has it been since a musical was brought to a halt by riotous jokes?
And the box office.
The very next day after that review, the box office took in $324,700.
Wait, from $18,000 to over $300,000?
In 24 hours. His review single-handedly saved the show. It ran for nearly 3 years.
That's just staggering. But the story gets weird, because that success didn't happen everywhere.
You're talking about London.
Yeah, the 1993 production. It got great reviews there too, but it closed in 4 months. Why?
That's the big question. One theory is just the economy. There was a bad recession in the UK.
But good shows can survive that.
True. So the other theory is that the show is just very American. It's a satire of Hollywood, of film noir. Maybe British and tourist audiences just didn't connect with the inside baseball humor.
The sources quote someone from the production blaming the declining sophistication of West End audiences.
Which is never a good look. Blaming the audience is not a great marketing strategy, but it is a very smart, very meta show.
Maybe too smart for its own good, at least back then.
Yeah.
But it came back, right? The 2014 Donmar Warehouse revival.
Yes, and it was a huge hit. Directed by Josie Rourke, it was in a smaller theater, and they used projections and a really crisp design to create the two worlds. It won the Olivier for Best Musical Revival.
So they were finally going to conquer the West End.
They planned a big transfer for 2020,
Oh, no.
March 2020.
Oh.
They started previews, the reviews were raves, and then on March 16th, the world shut down.
That is just a tragic noir ending right there.
It is a real gut punch.
So let's circle back to the end of the story itself. We left Stein and Stone yelling at each other. Stein's life is a disaster. How does it resolve?
Well, Stein finally hits his breaking point. He goes to the set and sees that Buddy, the producer, has put his own name on the screenplay credit above Stein's.
The ultimate betrayal.
So Stein just explodes. He makes this huge scene, tells Buddy off, and gets himself fired.
And the security comes.
Right. Two big guards come to throw him out. And in that moment, the wall between the two worlds just shatters. Stone, the fictional character, appears at Stein's typewriter.
Wait, the character starts writing the author.
He does. Stone sits down and starts typing, and suddenly, Stein, this nerdy writer, knows how to fight. He takes out both security guards.
No way.
The creation literally saves the creator.
I love that.
And then Stone types one last thing, a Hollywood ending. He writes a scene where Stein's wife, Gabby, comes back and forgives him.
So Stein only gets his happy ending because his character wrote it for him.
Exactly.
That's actually pretty cynical when you think about it.
It is. The show is winking at you. It's saying, here's your happy ending, but remember, it's a total fantasy. A magic typewriter made it happen.
It's a reminder that in real life, the guy with the typewriter usually just gets beat up.
Unless he can find a little bit of his own hero inside him. And that's really the final takeaway. They sing the finale, I'm nothing without you. They realize they're two halves of the same person. We need our fantasies, our stones, to survive being a Stein.
It's such a perfect balance of cynicism and a real love for storytelling, which leaves us with a final thought for you to think about.
I think I see where you're going.
In the show, the persona, this fictional character, literally takes over and rewrites the author's life.
Right.
And it makes you wonder about our own lives. We all create personas, you know, a work self, a social media self. You create these characters to navigate the world. But if you play them for long enough, do they eventually start writing you?
That is a fascinating question. Who's really sitting at the typewriter? Are you the author, or have you just become the character?
Something to chew on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the black and white and Technicolor world of City of Angels.
My pleasure.
We'll see you on the next one.